Welcome to Gain the Passion with hosts Todd Foster, Alyssa Stanley, and Kelly Scar.
Today, we have the opportunity to sit down with Chris Weidner. He is a world-renowned keynote speaker known for his keynote speech around America's number one influence and impact strategies. He is a member of the Motivational Speakers Hall of Fame, one of Inc. magazine's top 100 leadership speakers, named one of the top 50 speakers in the world. He is also a coach, an author, and he has co-wrote with some of the greats in the motivational speaking world.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Right on, Chris. Well, thanks again for being here. Why don't you give us kind of the Coles Notes version of who you are, what you're about, and let's dive into the conversation after that.
Awesome. Yeah, I've been a speaker since 1988. When I graduated college, I started out speaking to youth because I had a crazy upbringing. 28 homes, 11 different schools, shipped off to live with relatives twice, started drugs in the sixth grade, almost kicked out of school many, many times, 47 written referrals to the principal's office my 10th grade year, as my son would say, that's one every 4 days. Had a transformation summer before my senior year of high school, got a degree in youth and family work, became a youth director in New Jersey, of all places. I spent 3 years doing that till I realized I don't like youth. And after that, started speaking to adults, and I ended up ghostwriting for John Maxwell starting in 2001-ish. Started working with Jim Rohn in about 2002, wrote the Jim Rohn one-year program, and his last book, 12 Pillars, ended up with a TV show with Zig Ziglar for about a year and a half called True Performance, and have traveled the world, 2,500 speeches, 22 books, translated into 14 languages, including my best-selling book, The Angel Inside, which was number 2 on the Wall Street Journal, number 7 on the New York Times, and number 3 on Amazon for a week. So it's been a fun ride. It's taken me all over the world. Primarily, I speak on my book called The Art of Influence, but it's been great. I've done radio. I've done television. I've spoken all over, crowds as large as 25,000 people. And it's just been a mostly wonderful life, as the movie would be called if it was my movie.
Well, you've never said any of that before. I could tell that. But that was good.
But I said it faster this time.
So, Chris, it sounds like you were a fun kid back in the day. At what point in your life did you go, okay, either you were forced to grow up or did someone force you to grow up, or what was the story there?
Well, I was completely lost. My dad died when I was 4. My siblings were much older than me. So we basically had 2 families, mom, dad, and 3 siblings. And then I came along for a short little bit before my dad died, and then they all moved out. So my mom basically raised me as an only child. And I just went down the, down the drain. I was not a good kid. I was in trouble all the time. I was angry. And then summer before my senior year, I was spending the night with one of my friends who gets me into a lot of trouble. And it was a Saturday night. Sunday morning, his mother threw the door open and said, "Get up, we're going to Sunday school." And I literally had no idea what Sunday school was. I'd never heard of it. I'm like, well, I've done Monday through Friday school, and I've done almost everything else. What the heck? I'll give a Sunday school a try. And I met a guy who, he was a good old boy from Montana, and he was the youth director. And he had 2 things that he really did for me. Number 1, he had size 11 cowboy boots, if you know what I mean, and gave me a swift kick in the butt, told me I was going nowhere fast, and that I had a lot of talent, and that if I'd corral that, I could make something of my life. And then number 2, he taught me about God and about purpose and about the bigger picture, and understanding that I wasn't just some lost kid with no future, but that there was a plan for my life, and my job was to find that plan and fulfill it. And those were 2 great messages that I needed, and it turned my life around. And it certainly haven't been perfect, but I've been going in the right direction. And as John MacArthur always says, it's not your perfection, but your direction that counts. And I've been going in the right direction for, 40 something years now. And it's been quite a journey.
Chris, what do you think that message was that the size 11 cowboy boot kind of struck into you that actually made you stand up and listen? Because I'm assuming that you probably had other people in your life, along your journey that were saying, "Hey, come on, man, smarten up. Like, you're smarter than this. This is the path that you're on is insane." Like, what was it that he said that just completely, made you change your outlook on your path forward?
Well, it was more tone, I think. There were certainly people that told me I was screwing up. but nobody ever combined that with, and you've got a bright future. It was teachers who yelled at me and coaches that yelled at me and told me what a screw up I was. You know, the only reason I was able to play sports was because I was one of the best kids on every team. And otherwise, they'd have just booted me off. They sort of had to tolerate me. But coaches condemned me. Teachers condemned me, sent me to the principal's office. But for once, somebody said, yeah, you're screwing up, but there's a way to make something out of this. You've got great talents. You've got great skill sets. You've got a great personality. And it was basically somebody finally believed in me. And then, you know, from that point forward, I've had lots of people who believed in me. I had a professor in college who believed in me. And I was still really rough around the edges in college. But he allowed me to, in our college, everybody had to have some way that they gave back to the community. And the college had a thing that did feeding the homeless in Seattle on Skid Road. And he put me in charge of that team. And that was the first time anybody had invested any responsibility into me. He saw my negatives, but he knew that if he could give me some positive to replace them. And so he allowed me to use this personality that was tending to get me into trouble for something good. And, you know, he believed in me. When I got out of college, I had a mentor who was the CEO of Mars Candies. You know, just a little $35 billion a year company who believed in me. And, you know, all along the way, Kyle Wilson was the president of Jim Rohn International, who brought me into work with Jim, believed in me. Zig and Tom Ziegler believed in me. So all the way along in my career, I call them boosters, right? Bring on the boosters. I wrote an article once called Bring on the Boosters. We need people who will believe in us. And it's one of the things I try to do now as an older man. I'm 55 now. And so now I'm one of the older guys in the room a lot of the times. And I'll see young guys, young men and young women, and I'll tell them, I believe in you. I see what you can do. I see your greatness. And oftentimes we just have to borrow belief from somebody. And when people who were successful and older than me and people who were living lives that were different than mine believed in me, it made it easier for me to believe in myself.
So what did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, I wanted to be an NBA basketball player, but I was about 7 inches too short. I worked for the Seattle Supersonics from 77 till 84 for 7 years when I was 11 years old. You know, I tell people all the time, I do not have any celebrity-itis. Like, I don't care who you are. Put me in the room with the most famous person in the world, I could care less. Because when I was 11 years old, I was hanging out with Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, Dr. J, you know, all these guys, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Like literally, I just am not impressed by people in terms of, oh, they're a celebrity. But I wanted to be an NBA player. I was too short, too slow, and too not good enough. So I fell back on the fact that I could talk, and I've always made a living talking. Remember in high school when the homeroom buzzer hit and it's like, time to sit down. And then the guy came on the microphone. Welcome, everybody. It's Tuesday, February 4th, and let's stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. That was me. Today, we're serving fish sticks and tater tots, you know, that kind of thing. You know, and then, you know, if you're playing on the varsity team, the bus leaves at 4 o'clock outside the gym, don't miss it. And then in college, here's this kind of an interesting thing. In college, I went to a college, I knew I was not going to play basketball. So they had an open recruitment for the in-house basketball announcer, right? So about 8 of us showed up in the college auditorium basketball arena. And they said, okay, they handed us some sheets and it had the names of the players. And they said, all right, go up there and pretend that you're welcoming the crowd and take us all the way through the national anthem. And having gone to 750 NBA games, there was a guy named George Toles. And George Toles was the in-house announcer at the Seattle Coliseum, announcing all those NBA games. And prior to me getting the job, my mom had 4 front row seats to the game, feet right on the court. So I've been to hundreds and hundreds of games, and I heard George's voice in my head. So he said, who wants to go first? I said, I'll go first. I walked up, I hit the flips, and I said, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to Concordia College, Moorhead, Minnesota, where tonight your Concordia Cobbers are taking on the St. Thomas Tommies. Now for the starting lineups. I mean, I could still do it 40-something years later because I hear that tape in my head. And so, you know, then I ended up doing drive time radio. I've given 2,500 speeches. So it's always usually been around talking, which, you know, they always say that your greatest weakness is your greatest strength carried to its extreme. My greatest strength is talking. My greatest weakness is talking. So there you go. My tongue has gotten me all around the world, and it's also gotten me in a lot of trouble over the years.
I can relate. My mom always said growing up, man, if you could just make money spewing shit out of your mouth, you'd be a very rich man. Look at me, Mom. Look at me.
There you go. Right there.
I want to talk about your book, Chris, The Art of Influence. Maybe give us a quick synopsis of the book and let's dive into that conversation.
I had written the book, The Angel Inside, which took off very well, and then wrote Jim Rohn's book, 12 Pillars. And a couple people had told me you ought to write short little fiction books, sort of like the Ken Blanchard books. That's sort of my niche, right? Well, I had a 2-book deal with Random House. And so originally it was going to be The Secrets of Influence, but that name was already taken. So we changed it to The Art of Influence. And it's a story about a young guy who graduates from North Kellogg School of Business. And his grandmother gives him a little gift card, since he was the first kid to go to college, first kid to graduate with an MBA. She gives him a little gift card at a backyard barbecue. And in it, she says, you get to spend a week with Bobby Gold. And Bobby Gold is a fictional character who's one of the 10 richest men in America. And he says, how do you know Bobby Gold? Are you kidding me? He thought she was going senile. She said, oh, I guess I never told you. I was his nanny when he was growing up. And when I found out you were going into business, I asked him if he'd take you under his wing. So Bobby Gold is sort of a combination of sort of a swashbuckling business guy, sort of a Donald Trump business kind of guy combined with a Richard Branson, you know, very ostentatious. His jet was gold, you know, and all that. And by the way, his jet, I can't, probably shouldn't tell you exactly who it is, but a friend of mine is the private pilot for one of the very, very, very wealthiest guys in the world, top 5 guys in the world. And I called him up one day. I said, I got to write about a jet. Can I come down and look at yours? And he said, yeah, sure. Come on down. So it's actually a jet. It's his old jet. He sold it now. It's a Falcon 900 EX. He drives a 650 now. But anyway, that's actually a jet of one of the world's most well-known billionaires. So there's a lot of little, what do they call them in video games? Easter eggs in that. There's a scene in a baseball stadium that is based on a friend of mine who was the president of one of the Major League Baseball teams and some of those kinds of things. But it's fictional. It's usually a mentor-mentee kind of relationship. And in this one, Bobby Gold takes this young man, Marcus, under, and he says to him at the very beginning, he says, well, you graduated from Kellogg Business School, so I know you know the science of business. Now I'm going to teach you the art of business. And the art of business is to understand people and how to influence people. And it's four main lessons: integrity, which brings trust; optimism, which brings admiration; service, which brings loyalty; and excellence, which brings respect. So how to gain trust, respect, admiration, and loyalty from people. And this fictional little stories are easy for people to read. I call them one leg stories, because you can read them on one leg of an airplane trip. And I also tell people nobody's going to accuse me of having gone to MIT after reading one of my books. They're just a little bit longer than a long coloring book.
How did you discover you were a writer? I sit down and I'll write something. I have writer's block, and it will take me 3 hours to write one sentence, let alone 20,000.
Well, I actually write my books in a week, and here's how I do it. I study and study and study and study and study and study and study, and then I'll go into a Starbucks or someplace Monday through Friday. I start at 8 a.m., and I leave at 5 p.m. or as soon as I get to 4,000 words for the day. And at the end of the week, I have 20,000 words, and I send them to an editor. But I'll tell you how I ended up doing that. When I was, I had written books prior to Angel Inside, which became the bestseller. And at the time, I had just gotten rid of my last ghostwriting client. I said, I'm not doing ghostwriting anymore, because I was giving all my best ideas away. And because I have integrity, I would be sitting there typing and I'd come up with this idea. And I'm like, I'm on the clock. I got to give it to him. And I give it to him. Nobody would have known except me. Right. But I thought, I got to give it to him. And so I said, the only way out of this is for me to not ghostwrite for anybody. So there were a few books that were big at the time, a few ideas. There was The Da Vinci Code was big. And there was a book called How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci. And so I thought, Da Vinci, I wonder if there's. And so those who know Renaissance history know that there were 4 people who lived in Florence in the early 1500s. Raphael was there. He was sort of in and out. But Da Vinci lived there. Machiavelli lived there. You know, Florence in the early 1500s was sort of the birth of citizen legislature. And Machiavelli wrote The Prince, didn't want to write about lie, cheating, and stealing. Didn't think that would be much of a personal self-help book. So that left me with Michelangelo. And I didn't know much about Michelangelo. So I spent about 6 months studying, reading books. I read The Agony and the Ecstasy. Actually, I watched the movie The Agony and the Ecstasy starring Charlton Heston. And just tons and tons of research, studied maps of the city of Florence. Now we do food and wine tours there. I was married in a vineyard outside of Florence a few years ago, at the old Medici family farmhouse, which is now a 28-room boutique hotel owned by the Antonari family, which is the world's largest vineyard, oldest vineyard as well. And so I was going to write a book on life lessons from Michelangelo, and I got two pieces of advice that literally changed the course of my writing history. One was from Charlie Tremendous Jones. Do you guys remember Charlie Tremendous Jones? Charlie Tremendous Jones was a contemporary of Zig Ziglar and Jim Rohn. He's passed away now. He had the most dynamic personality of any human being I've ever met. Very, very funny guy. You should watch some old videos of his. For example, he would always say, I've been married 55 years. And what happens when you say that? Everybody, oh, that's amazing. And he'd say, stop, 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 stop. And everybody pauses. He says, only 47 of them were any good. And everybody, he said to me, he owned a company called Executive Books out of Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. And he said, Chris, I got some advice for your next book. Make it short. Nobody reads long books anymore. Make it short. So I went into a Barnes & Noble in Bellevue, Washington, a converted bowling alley. And I went to picked up a Ken Blanchard book. I counted how many words on a page. I multiplied by pages, and it was 20,000 words. The second piece of advice, again, just sort of random piece of advice, a guy named Mark Sanborn, and you guys probably know Mark. He wrote a best-selling book. I think it sold 5 million copies now, called The Fred Factor, one of the top speakers of the last 30 years, former president of National Speakers Association, probably been featured in Success Magazine many times. And he said, Chris, you ought to make it fiction. And I went, fiction. Well, the great thing about fiction, you can make anything up, right? I mean, so you don't want to make up facts or things like that. But I love writing fiction because you can construct anything that you want to, and you can take those lessons and put them right into something. And so that's what I did. I found 10 life lessons out of the life of Michelangelo, and I wrote that book, and people loved it. And still to this day, I get emails from people saying that book changed my life. And it was published. We self-published it. Jim Rohn International self-published it. We sold 120,000 copies before we sold it to Random House. And then it debuted number 2, number 7, and number 3. The one that I like the number 3 on Amazon, though, because it was literally actually number 3. A lot of times people say number 1 best-selling, but it's books, you know, business books for men, business books for men in accounting, business books for men in accounting who've worked less than 7 years. You know, it's like 14 divisions down. This was actually number 3, and it was behind the pre-launch of Harry Potter, the pre-release of Harry Potter, and the lost book of J.R.R. Tolkien that his grandson found in his attic after his grandpa died. So I'm like, if you're going to be number 3, it may as well be behind the greatest fiction series of all time and the guy who wrote Lord of the Rings. I mean, okay, I kind of right. felt like I was number 1.
Yeah.
So, and it's the only book I love. I like all of my books. I love that book. It is in my opinion, pun intended, I guess, it really is a masterpiece. And I really kind of even think God really helped me write it, because it's a perfect blend of history, art, geography, spirituality, self-help. And there's just nugget after nugget after nugget in that book. And it's the only book of mine that I love, love, love. I love the book. And it's been in 14 languages. The last one just picked up a couple years ago. In the last couple of years, another one of the Chinese derivatives picked it up. So I'm very proud of that book, proud of all my books, but I really love that book.
Writers perplex me because it takes a lot to put, like, I have so many thoughts going on in this head of mine, but sometimes to put it down on paper is, I mean, it's a real struggle, right? So, and the whole world of ghostwriting perplexes me as well, because the amount of blood, sweat, and tears, intellectual property, all of the things that you pour into that paper for, I mean, sometimes a ghostwriting contract is about 9 to 12 months, right?
So you spend all that time and then you just like hand this baby over. How do you do that? I would have a really hard time doing that because then they publish it, right? And it's their name on it.
To find the right ghostwriter. And my first ghostwriting, I wrote his articles. I didn't write any of his books, but I worked for about 18 months writing John Maxwell's nationally syndicated column. And early 2000s. And one of the reasons they picked me was because John was a former pastor turned business speaker. I was a former pastor turned business speaker. So you want to find somebody that gets your worldview, gets your voice. That's very, very important to do. And so, and I did struggle with it. I struggled with ghostwriting. I remember one time I was sitting at Starbucks and I was writing an article, and at the top it said, you know, John Maxwell. I was writing the article, and it was funny because I lived in Seattle, and I was in a suburb of Seattle where they pioneered all the things they wanted to try. So ours was 4,500 square feet. It was the first time they ever had fireplaces, first place they ever had all the luxury, you know, big overstuffed chairs, first time they ever had a boardroom set up. And there was a guy on the other side of my laptop, and he was sitting there for 3 or 4 hours. And at one point, I kind of just took a break and I leaned back, and he said, he stopped too, and he said, "Hey, what do you do?" And I said, I'm a writer and speaker. And he said, "What do you write about?" And I said, "Leadership and stuff." And he goes, "Oh, I love leadership." And I said, "Oh, really? Like, who do you like?" And he goes, "John Maxwell, my favorite writer of all time." I'm like, "Yeah, he's amazing." And, you know, and John does a lot of his books, I think, collaboratively with Charlie Wetzel. And they usually have a whole team there. So it's not really sort of true ghostwriting. I mean, they do the writing. But you want to find somebody that gets it, that has that. You know, that has that worldview and can find your voice. There are people that I would never ghostwrite for because I would never be able to capture their voice. But it was really easy for me to work with John, and it was a great privilege. I mean, what an amazing guy, an amazing writer, an amazing speaker, amazing business guy, and the ministry that he's compelled all over the world as well. Just a great privilege at the very beginning of the trajectory of my career. It wasn't the beginning of my career, but it was really that first ramp up. But it's important to find somebody. I just ghost wrote a book when COVID hit and I lost all my speaking engagements because there were no more meetings. The CEO of a very large clothing company, very well-known clothing company, wanted to write a book. And it was easy for me. It was easy because we have very similar perspectives and things like that. So you want to find somebody that shares your worldview, your perspective, and really even your tone, I guess. You know, I could never write for somebody who's just straight laced and buttoned up, and I couldn't do it because I'm too snarky and too, you know, I try to make things funny and light and snarky, and I haven't even turned the snark button on yet. So hopefully if we get warmed up here, we can get really snarky. But no, you want to find same kind of tone. But it's fun. But eventually I decided I wanted to, I remember I wrote something one day and I remember thinking, wow, that's a really good turn of a phrase. I should keep it. And then I went, no, I can't keep it. I got it. But I didn't like it because I knew that I was going to write it for someone else. They were going to say it and get famous for saying it. And when I said it, they'd be like, he's stealing from that guy. And I'm like, no, it was actually came out of this noggin. So I decided to make a change. And for almost 20 years, I didn't do any ghostwriting. And then with COVID, I had a friend. He's a friend of mine, the CEO. And so he asked me if I'd help him. And I did. It was fun.
How were you able to set your ego aside? That's I mean, you know, we're all human beings. Everybody's got ego, right? How do you set your ego aside? Yeah, that, you know, and he, for our listeners, he's got
you pay a lot to set your ego aside.
Right. They're paying you a lot to set your ego aside. Okay, I gotcha. Yeah. No, very interesting stuff, man. I mean,
it wasn't the ego. It was the ethics. I struggled with the ethics of ghostwriting.
Expand on that a little bit.
I've struggled with it. And then, you know, but then I one of the things I always used to say is, look, no, do you think George Foreman's making all those grills? Of course not. George Foreman's not making all those grills. Like, you don't go, hey, George, I need a grill. All right, let me wire one up for you. You know, he got people making those grills, but it's the George Foreman grill. So, you know, and ghostwriting is a dirty little secret. A lot of the books you're reading, particularly by famous people, they did not write. A lot of them. And it's the dirty little secret in the industry. And there's a lot of ghostwriters make a lot of money. You know, to John's credit, he always gives Charlie credit in his books. You open the acknowledgments. Thank you to my writer, Charlie Wetzel. I always thought Charlie had the best job in the world. He gets paid a ton of money. He gets a piece of the action, and he can walk through an airport without getting mobbed. You know, it's like a backup quarterback in the NFL. Hey, I'm a quarterback yeah. in the NFL, you know, I never get hit. Right. But I have two friends who were backup quarterbacks in the NFL, Tom Flick and Jeff Kemp. And I said that to him once at a luncheon we were at, and they both got angry at me because those guys want to play. They want to play. I'm like, you guys got the best gig in the world, backup quarterback in the NFL. And they like, what are you talking about? I'm going to take the snaps. So anyway, but yeah, so I don't think it's unethical. It's just for me, it felt like I want to write my own stuff. I'm going to own my own stuff. But again, it was, you know, writing with Jim Rohn was an amazing opportunity for me. You know, I will be the only person for all of eternity that gets to say I wrote his last book. You know, and then after he passed, I wrote a sequel to the book called Above All Else. And so that was kind of fun as well.
When you're writing their voices, do you hear their voices in your head? Like, you know, I'm assuming you're writing in your words, yet you hear their voice, right? The deep baritone of Maxwell.
Well, you know, yeah, like, I've got five lessons for you, folks. They all start with, you know, that'd be John or Will Zig Ziglar. Zig Ziglar sounds a little bit like Ronald Reagan with a Southern accent, but and you just add the letter A to the end of every word. And no, I don't do that. And of course, Jim, I always love talking about Jim and Zig when they speak, because Zig pranced the stages. That's the number one question I get all the time. What was it like to work with Jim and Zig? Literally almost every podcast. What was it like to work with Jim and Zig? They were completely different. And the lesson that I learned from working with those two guys was to be yourself. And the reason why is because those two guys, they hit the upper echelon of that business, and they could not have been more different. And yet they were friends. Zig would prance the stage and he'd march, and then he'd get down on his knee and he'd yell, and then he'd whisper sometimes, you know. And Jim never left the lectern. Like, I always joke, this is Jim's big power move, man. You knew he was fired up when he would take off his reading glasses. Like, whoa, Jim's coming out, right? He just took his reading glasses off. We're about to get unbridled Jim Rohn here. But I realized I didn't need to be Zig and I didn't need to be Jim. I needed to be Chris. And that's the biggest lesson I learned. I learned lots of lessons, but the one that stuck with me the most was I didn't need to be them. I needed to be me. And they proved that to me by being them. And they both hit the highest levels. I mean, you know, you name the top five motivational speakers of all time, and those two are always going to be in that list.
When did you feel like you finally hit it big?
When did I finally feel like I hit it big? Probably when The Angel Inside hit the best-selling list, because I was working with Jim. I would travel a little bit with him. I'd do, you know, some of the events, the Jim Rohn Weekend Leadership event, which was Anaheim, July 30th through like August 1st or 2nd, 2004. And I emceed that event. We sold tons of that. Those DVDs went worldwide and sort of people started knowing me. But when I really felt like I had achieved what I wanted to achieve was when I gave my first speech on a stage of over 20,000 people. And that's when I kind of really went, wow, this is what I always wanted.
I have a question about where he said that he didn't like working with youth anymore.
I was a youth director and I was leading a Bible study talking about something like really important, and some kid ripped a fart, and I went to college for this. I literally went to college for this. I spent all that money to have some kid fart in the middle of my talk. And that was kind of like, I'm done. But no, I coached high school basketball and I loved that. And I do like kids. I like my own kids. You know, they're not teenagers anymore. But no, that I can still remember the kid's name, and I won't embarrass him because he's probably 40 now, but I still remember his name. And I remember thinking, I'm out of here. I'm not going to do this. I spent way too much money in college for this.
Yeah, you think that one fart changed your life. From that one fart.
When you think about working for the Seattle Supersonics, meeting my youth director, working with John Maxwell, Zig Ziglar, and Jim Rohn, and a fart that an eighth grader let in New Jersey, all pivotal moments of my life.
That's when you knew you hit it big.
That's when I knew I hit it. But no, that's when I knew I was leaving that and I was going to go hit it big. Alyssa's like, I did not see that turn coming.
I know, and I love that one. That was great. That's the first time we've ever had anyone say they were driven by a fart to do better in life.
I was ready for you to be like, there was this kid who wasn't listening and really disrespectful and blah, blah, blah. I did not see.
Well, I will tell you this about, I will tell you this though. I have lots of kids. I mean, I had a significant impact and sometimes, and this is a great lesson. Sometimes it's the kid you never know you impacted or the person in your office you never knew you impacted. And I'll give you two stories. I'll start with the kid. Well, I'll start with the kid in college. First of all, a girl I went to college with, I went to a very pretty small college. And I knew her. I never spent any time with her outside of school, but, you know, we were in almost every class together. And my senior year of college, you know, you get your annual or whatever, you know, and you write, you know, stay cool, see you next summer, you know, whatever. But she wrote to me at the end of our senior year, and it's the only comment I can remember anybody wrote to me in any annual ever, junior high school or college. She said, "Thank you for asking all the questions I was too afraid to ask." And I still remember that to this day. It's the only thing I can ever remember anybody writing because I got in trouble for asking a lot of questions. But the second one was after I left the ministry as a youth minister in New Jersey, there was a kid that used to come to youth group with, he had two or three really good friends that were very involved and he kind of just tagged along. Well, I moved out to Seattle and he died in a fire, a home fire. And the pastor who I had worked with out there, he wrote to me and he said, "I never knew you had such an impact in his life." And I went, "I didn't know that I did either. What are you talking about?" At his funeral, he had written his college entrance exam about me. And it got him into one of America's most prestigious Ivy League schools. And it was about the impact I had on his life. And if you would have said, name the top 20 kids you had an impact on in that youth group, he would not have even been, because I didn't know it. He was absorbing like a sponge, but he was a quiet kid and he hung around with two louder kids. So anytime we were together, it was mainly engaging with those, you know, loud, gregarious kids. And it made me realize you just never know who you're impacting. You never know. And I was in an unfortunate way, fortunate to find out, but it was a good life lesson for me. But, you know, it came at the expense of him passing away in a house fire.
So you went from, let me get the timeline right here. You somehow got into college after being a so-called troublemaker.
The check cleared. That was the primary way to get into my college. If the check cleared, you're in.
It still works. It's amazing how that works.
Because I was 149th out of 172 kids in my high school class. You know, Zig always says I was in the half of the class that made the top half possible. I was in the 10th of the class that made the top 90% possible.
So you made everyone else look good.
I've always been doing that, Todd. That's a big gift of mine.
Yeah. So you went from high school to college, and then you got into the ministry, and then you went over to Seattle.
Yep.
And then were you lost, or how did you get wrapped up in the whole Maxwell Barone Ziegler thing?
Well, so I was what they call a church planter in Seattle. That means you start a church and they give you no money to help.
Oh, okay. So, great.
So I moved into and Seattle, greater Seattle area where I grew up, is one of the least churched states in the union. Like 8% of people go to church in Washington State, particularly Seattle area. And they had no money for me. So I started speaking and writing to make money. So I started doing little motivational speeches. I mean, I started out doing youth groups and summer groups and colleges and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then the Kiwanis and the Rotary and this and that and the other thing. And then I got on the internet very, very early, which was nice because I was in Seattle. And I remember I had a fax journal. There was a thing called the Cairo Radio News Fax. It was 4 pages, came out every day. It was the top of the news. So I created one called the American Community Business Network, and it was 4 pages of computer tips, customer service tips. We had tens of thousands of subscribers, and then I licensed it all across America, and I always left the bottom third of the page where they could put in localized advertising. So I sent them the copy for the week, and then they would put in cut and paste using Microsoft Publisher, and I built it up so big, and then the internet hit. And in Seattle, everybody had email. So I'm like, screw this fax thing. I'm going email, baby. So I sent one last fax that said, we're done. It's all on email. Sign up here. And I went from tens of thousands of people to 800 people on my email list.
Wow.
And then I built it to 100,000 people. And I met Kyle Wilson at Jim Rohn International. And then I got out of the pastorate, the full-time ministry. I mortgaged my house. My house was worth like $300,000. I took a $100,000 mortgage on the house. September 26, 2002, I put on my first conference. I hired John Maxwell. I hired Vince Lombardi Jr. And I hired the first guy at Mount Everest, one of the founders of REI. Name escapes me. I've actually got a picture of him right there. Big one he sent me. First guy in May of 1964.
Hillary?
Huh?
Hillary?
No. Although, by the way, parenthetically, do you know that Zig Ziglar's real name is Hillary? Just a little tidbit. That's free of charge. That's in his book. He says, now you know why they call me Zig. But anyway, I can't remember the guy's name. And it really makes me upset because he was a fantastic speaker. And I lost a bunch of money on that event. And then I did another one with John where we actually made some money. So I was kind of broken even on two events. And I'm like, I am not going to keep doing the event business. So I just was speaking. And I had gotten to know John and his team. There was a guy named Kevin Small there and David Hoyt and Mark Cole. And some of those guys were all over there and got to know them. And they brought me in to write with John. And then at that point, Kyle and Jim Rohn said, hey, why don't you come do that with us? And so I did that. And from there, it was great.
Once you're done ghostwriting, do you become a ghost to the people you wrote for? Or are you still close or friends with these people at all?
You know, I was never really friends. I was friendly. I mean, it's not like any of those guys and I went on vacation together. But, you know, Zig, actually, I got the TV show with Zig primarily because in probably 2004, 2005, I started a business called Made for Success. And we licensed audio programs from other speakers. This was another way I made myself famous. This is kind of a strategy that I used. So we licensed on a non-exclusive basis. My first guy I called was Mark Sanborn. I said, send me a CD that you want me to sell and make you some money, and you keep all the rights to it, but I will pay you every time I sell it. And then we created like 18 different SKUs, and it was boxed sets. It was success, leadership, verbal command, sales success. And we would put 14 CDs and one DVD in a box, and we were selling them through Costco and Sam's Club. And we were selling 50 to 75,000 boxes a month through Costco and Sam's Club. And we're making amazing money doing it. And so you got 15 people in there. And so you got a big giant box. They could have fit in a small box, but in Costco, they want you to feel like, you know, you're lugging out your CDs to the car, you know, or whatever. So the giant boxes, and it had a flap on the front. So on the front was the name, and it had four people's names on the front. If you wanted to know who else was in it, you open the flap and there were the rest. Well, on the cover, I always had three famous people. So I'd have John Maxwell, Zig Ziglar, Jim Rohn, or Dennis Waitley, or Brian Tracy, or somebody like that. But Chris Widener was always the fourth name. And so I branded myself on, I was the only one on every box. And then I swapped out the other three famous people. And that was one of the ways I built my brand. I was selling, you know, probably 600,000 to a million copies a year through Costco for quite a few years. And everybody was hearing my CDs and everybody was seeing my name. And then, of course, Jim Rohn was pushing me. And then Zig Ziglar and I had the TV show. And from 2004 to 2009, it really just exploded out that way.
So 2009 hits, then what?
I got into politics. And you probably don't want to talk politics, which is fine, but we can talk in sort of a generic way. But one of my best friends ran for governor. And he was relatively unknown. And he said, look, you're the professional speaker. Will you help me? So I wrote his speech and I traveled 3 or 4 days a week with him. And he ended up winning that race. They had a recount and he won again, and they had another recount and he lost, and we'll just leave it at that. But that was my thing into politics. And I ended up, I've done speech coaching for everybody running for president of the United States all the way down to dog catcher. Well, maybe not that low, city council. And so I help. In fact, I just moved to Chattanooga, and one of the first people I met, she's running for Hamilton County mayor, which is kind of county executive. And the first thing they asked me to do was, can you do coaching, speech coaching, debate coaching, stuff like that? So yeah, I like doing that. I like helping other people find their voice and find their stories and convince and persuade and influence other people. And then I ran for the U.S. Senate in 2010. or as I like to call it, my ill-fated run for the U.S. Senate. And so I ended up doing that. And it was a lot of fun, though. I mean, my kids, we were on the road. I went to Walla Walla, Washington more times than anybody would ever want to go to Walla Walla, Washington. Although Walla Walla has become this amazing wine center, like within like 20 miles of downtown Walla Walla, a town so good you say it twice. There are like 350 vineyards and tasting rooms. It's a spectacular place. You know, get out of Napa and go up to Walla Walla and the upper end of that Willamette Valley, Oregon, up into Washington, and really some great wines in Washington State. And I love seeing them. You know, I was just in Houston this last weekend and went to this little wine bar, and they actually had four or five Washington wines there. It was really, really great to see. It's an underestimated or unrecognized place of some really great wines, particularly I think Pinot Noirs are good out of Walla Walla.
If you are enjoying this episode, please leave a 5-star review at your favorite podcast provider.
So I'd like to piggyback then on your political career, the short-lived one you had. You seem like you're not a person who quits or gives up. And if you're like me or anyone else out there, a high D, you're very competitive and you want to win, and you did not win and you never went and ran again. So do you believe you didn't have the belief in it in the first place, or was it more of the game or the thrill of the catch? Or?
No, I'll tell you exactly what happened. We had like 13 people running, and we had one very far person who was sort of out here. And I realized that he was going to get 25% of the vote because he was the only one who staked that position out. And the rest of us were like center, you know, and I knew he's going to get 25 and the rest of us were going to split 75. And I realized there was no way I could win. The people from Washington, D.C. were calling me and they were saying, hey, would you be willing to get out of the race so that your friend could get in? Mm-hmm. Because they wanted somebody who would raise a bunch of money and spend a bunch of money so that my opponent would have to spend her entire war chest. Because otherwise, if they don't spend the money, they can give it to everybody else. So it was kind of a chess piece move is what it was. So it was sort of a combination of I realized there was no way I could win, and I took one for the team. So I thoroughly enjoyed it. I loved meeting people. I loved speaking to crowds. I loved that my children got to see their dad involved in the civic discourse. And you know, that's what America's about. We're about self-governance. And I don't care if you're left, right, middle, run for office, make your voice heard. You know, that's what makes America great, is we're one of the few places on earth that has freedom of speech. And I think everybody's voice ought to be heard. You know, I think all sides ought to be heard, because we are about the free flow of information and the exchange of ideas. And that's what makes us unique. You go to some countries and they say, here's what we believe. And you say, I don't believe that. And they go, come with us behind the building. Yep. And you're done. Right. One of the things that makes us great is that we get to say what we believe, whether it's on point or totally crazy. But that's the beauty of it, is we have to figure out what's right by hearing all the different sides. So I was proud to have participated in it. And you never know. Who knows? You might see me running for something else in the future. I'm now in Tennessee. And for those of you who can figure it out, I feel like I'm finally home in Tennessee. Feel like I'm finally home. So I love Tennessee.
I got two things here. Number one, the only reason I would ever run for office would for me to find out what I did in my early 20s. And
believe me, they will find out.
Oh, yes, they will. And number two, why Chattanooga now?
Well, it's interesting. I have two daughters. One goes in, I have six children, but these two daughters, one goes to Vanderbilt. The other goes to University of Alabama. And so my wife and I were living in Scottsdale. She had only ever lived in Los Angeles and Scottsdale. I had only ever lived in Seattle and Scottsdale, except for going to college in Minnesota. And we said, let's pack up and move closer to the girls. Well, halfway in between the girls, between Nashville and Tuscaloosa, is Huntsville. And I didn't want to live in Huntsville. And so equidistant is Chattanooga. And so we ended up picking Chattanooga, and if you got time for a story, it's unbelievable, because people still say, why'd you move to Chattanooga? I say, I have no idea. On July 5th, 2020, we came out to Chattanooga, and in all my speeches, I'd never been to Chattanooga. And we land in Chattanooga. We spend the night at the hotel. We've been there 12 hours. We get up in the morning. My wife says, will you go down to the coffee shop in the lobby and get us some coffee? I'm going to jump in the shower and get ready. We're going to go look for houses. I said, sure. And I said, before I left, it's 7:45 a.m. I said, God, this is the craziest thing I've ever done, packing up and move to a city I've never even been to before. I said, just give me a sign. I don't ask for a lot of signs. Give me a sign. I go down into the lobby, walk into the coffee shop, start. I'm the only one there. It's in the middle of COVID. I'm the only one there. Kid behind the counter. He's about 20 years younger than me. And we get to talking. And I said, so have you lived in Chattanooga your whole life? And he says, no. He says, how about you? And I said, no. We're thinking about moving here. I live in Scottsdale now, but I grew up 50 years in Seattle. And he goes, oh, what part of Seattle? I said, oh, a little bedroom community about 30 miles east of Seattle. And it's called Snoqualmie. And he looks at me and he cocks his head and he goes, did you graduate from Mount Si High School? And I said, I did graduate from Mount Si High School. He stuck his fist out to give me a fist bump, said, so did I, buddy. And believe me, it gets better. So I said, interesting. And I said, what's your last name? And he said his last name. And I said, do you know this other guy who was a pastor friend of mine, same last name? And he says, I love Pastor Monty. Pastor Monty's the greatest guy. Oh, he's amazing. But no, we share the last name, but we're not related. I said, oh. Well, that's really interesting. And then I said, do you know these people? Yeah, I went to school with their kids. Do you know these people? I went to school with their kids. Do you know these people? We knew like 100 people. And then after talking for 10 or 15 minutes about all the people we knew, he says, do you know what's really weird? And I said, what? He goes, do you know where I moved when I left Snoqualmie? I said, where? He said, Scottsdale. I said, yeah, that's weird. And he goes, and do you know what's even weirder? I said, what's that? He said, do you know where I moved when I left Scottsdale? And I said, I'm guessing Chattanooga. And he goes, how weird is that? And I said, weirder than you will ever know. And I walk back up and my wife goes, what took you 30 minutes to get coffee? I said, you are not going to believe this story. And literally from that point forward, we were moving to Chattanooga. And people say, why you moved to Chattanooga? I have no idea. I still to this day do not know why we moved to Chattanooga. But I believe there's a purpose to it.
Yeah, my biggest fear would have been him saying eventually, Dad.
Or do you know what happened after I moved to Chattanooga? I came down with cancer. Like that would have been like the part I didn't want to hear or something. You know what I mean? But yeah, Dad, no, I know all my kids are, Todd.
Oh, good. That's good.
Chris, you have an ability to almost like shapeshift in different stages of life, in shifting to what you think needs to happen, or maybe what your gut tells you what needs to happen, or what God tells you what needs to happen. What do you contribute to that ability to shift what seems like so seamlessly, shift and make things happen in the new sphere of wherever you're shifting?
I think moving all the time. When I was a kid, I really think I can build instant rapport with people, like instant rapport. You could throw me into a room. I went to a giant fundraiser the minute I got here. And the first thing I did, I walk into this giant 12,000 square foot mansion. You've been to a fundraiser before, right? You walk in, you get your wine, and you sit on the corner and go, okay, who am I going to talk to? And I ended up talking to the vice president of Cumulus Radio. Like he walked over to me, hey, let me introduce myself. And then the owner of the house, and he's like, let's go to lunch. I want to find out more about what you do. Like God has given me a gift to really just connect with people. And I think it was because growing up, it was sink or swim. I think there's probably some kids that would have lived in 28 homes, went to 11 different schools who would be wallflowers and just say, I can't deal with this. But I moved and I walked in and it was sink or swim. Like you either learn how to meet people, connect with people. I find people interesting. I really find people interesting. Darren Hardy told me when I had my interview show on TSTN, he said, your show is my favorite show. And I said, well, why? And he said, you just give these great interviews. What makes you such a great interview? And I said, I think I just find people interesting. And if they're interesting to me, I think they'll be interesting to everybody else. If I just get interested and ask questions, I'm probably going the same direction as everybody else. So probably that, and probably because my dad died when I was 4, and I realized that life is short. So life is short. You make the most of it. My brother, when he turned 41, my mom called him up and she said, happy birthday. And he's, oh, thanks a lot. And she said, how are you doing? And he said, oh, great. You know, and she said, well, you don't really sound great. And she said, well, I got to tell you, got to be honest with you. The last year I've been afraid of dying. And she said, why have you been afraid of dying? And my brother said, well, you know, Dad died when he was 40. And when I turned 40, I was afraid I was going to die. So I'm glad I'm 41 now. And my mother, and only my mother could have done this. She said, your dad wasn't 40 when he died. He was 41. So my brother spent the whole next year afraid he was going to die. Over 2 years, he thought he was going to die. But I think that probably moving around a lot, you have to learn how to connect with people and make changes and make do with what's happened. And then I think understanding that life is short, or life can be short. In 12 Pillars, Jim and I wrote that you can't determine how long you live, but you can determine how well you live. And I think that that's what I want to do. I want to live life well. And I've had some extraordinary opportunities. I think I'm the only person in the history of the world that has spoken in Cairo, Egypt, and Los Angeles, California in the same day. I've ridden in a ticker tape parade when the Seattle Supersonics won the world championship. I was 13 years old, 500,000 people were driving down through the thing in these old cars and waving to the crowd. And, you know, where do you go from there at 13? Like, how do you ever top that? You know, I've stood on stage with 25,000 people in front of me. I've written best-selling books, and really, you know, not to brag, but it's just it really has been a humbling thing. Like, I look back on my life and I think this has been a heck of a ride, and I'm so thankful and grateful to God that you know, I've got great kids, I've got an amazing life, I got a wonderful wife. I've been able to travel and do great things. I've made millions. I've lost millions. You know, everything. And it's an enjoyable life. Enjoy it each and every day, because you never know. You just never know. Some of us get 100 years. Some of us get 60. Some of us get 10. But, you know, there's some kids that die at an early age, you know, who make more of an impact than somebody who just breathes air for 70 years. So it's about how well you live, not about how long you live.
That's a great point. And I think you kind of nailed this without, you know, possibly a lot of people listening to this podcast may not be able to connect the dot, but you moving 28 times truly is your superpower. Like, you really kind of tied into that. You talk about moving 28 times in 11 years as kind of this idea of how tough your life was. And I'm sure that it was tough. I'm not minimizing it, but you were able to turn it into a superpower and something that's actually propelled you forward. We moved here, you know, I've only moved a couple of times in my life, and, you know, I'm Canadian. So when we grow roots somewhere, we grow roots. Like, we're firmly planted, and it's we're not
a big story there. It's called roots.
There you go. That's part of it. But, you know, at the end of the day, we don't move around as much as Americans do. I've got a lot of American friends, and this seems to be a common theme with Americans, is that they move all over the country. They just pick up and they'll go, right? Yeah. Whereas with Canadians, we just don't. And so, you know, I've moved maybe 3-4 times in my life. We made a move from one province to another, from a big city to a smaller city. And my wife and I were really worried about how our kids were going to adapt. And, you know, the resiliency that you show as a child is insane. I wish you could just bottle that up and sell it, because goddamn, you'd be a millionaire, you know, billionaire, trillionaire, whatever. I mean, if you could bottle that up and just to sell it to people, it really is crazy. So I guess I wanted to point that out, Chris, more than anything else, is, you know, you kind of turn this around. What a lot of people could look at and say, God, you know, he must have really had a tough life. Man, you did something, and you were able to turn it around and really use it as your cloak, I guess, as your cape.
I learned it from my mother. Success secrets I learned from my single mom. And, you know, my mom, we lived in a house that recently sold for $3 million. It was the biggest house in Sandpoint Country Club in Seattle, which was at the time probably the second most prestigious country club. My dad was the fifth partner at NBBJ, which is one of the top 30 architecture firms in the world. I think they just did the Facebook campus or the Google campus. He made $90,000 the last year he was alive, 1969. He was doing very, very well, but he had $30,000 worth of life insurance. So my mom had to sell that house because she couldn't afford the $400 a month mortgage payment. And she had not worked outside the home for 15 years. And so she started selling real estate, and she flipped houses long before it was on television. And, you know, so she went to work and she made something happen, and she took care of me. And so I learned that resilience from my mom. She never complained, never whined. She hauled her cookies off to work. She sold houses at night. I was a latchkey kid before you had the term latchkey kid. I had my key on my shoestring around my neck, you know, and part of the reason I got in trouble was that she was gone in the evenings. But, you know, there's an upside and downside to everything. But resilience I learned from my mom. And then I think I have a fighting spirit. I want to make the most out of life. I think anybody can reach deep. I think anybody can reach deep. It's in there. It's a matter of whether you have the courage to reach deep and the tenacity to reach deep and just always be able to keep hope alive and know that there's something better. I mean, I've had my back against the wall so many times and I just refuse to quit because there's got to be a way out. There's got to be something that can come good out of this. And I've found it to be pretty generally true.
I've realized by being in coaching and being a public speaker and doing training and consulting that most of us out there doing this have had mess ups in the past. Either, I mean, lots of them, right? I relate to a lot of what you went through, not the 48 times moving and that type of thing. Yet I believe it makes us stronger. Many times what we do is we end up getting scared of what's next. And you're one of these guys, it sounds like, who just says, the heck with it. I mean, the worst can happen is I die. How would you, coach someone into getting over that fear of doing something different?
I think just show them the option. Okay, jump forward 30 years. Now you're on your deathbed. Now you just have regrets. You know, Tony Campolo, remember Tony Campolo? He was a speaker boy 40 years ago, and he became famous for a speech he gave. He was a professor at Eastern University, and he gave a speech called It's Friday, But Sunday's Coming. And he was sort of a pastor, but he really wasn't a pastor. He was ordained, I think. And it was about, you know, Easter, right? On Friday, it's Friday, and he just died, and it's Saturday, and everybody's like, oh no, our guy just died. What's going to happen now? And he said, it's Friday, but Sunday's coming. And he just gave it. He gave a great speech. He became famous over that speech. But he wrote a book called Who Switched the Price Tags? And he was a sociologist professor, if I remember right. And he did a study of octogenarians. And he went to people 80 plus and said, you know, what do you most regret in your life? And the number one answer was not taking more risks. People play it safe. And the problem is this, there's an end. And typically speaking, you get weaker and weaker, more and more tired, more and more frail, you know, unless one of these billionaires can figure the fountain of youth. It's just the way it works, right? I mean, look at this. Those of you who can see, I got wrinkles, man. I didn't have these when I was 20 years old. I earned every one of these wrinkles and I got gray hair now. It's just the way it works. And pretty soon you're going to be old and frail enough that you can't go hike the Appalachian Trail, you know, and those kinds of things and go to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and all the things. And so I think you just have to say, what do you want the end of your life? You know, one of the first, I don't know if it's the first of Covey's seven habits. I think it is. Begin with the end in mind. When I get to the end, man, I want to be able to say I did it all. I want to be able to say I did it all. Now, doing it all doesn't mean a lot of the ones that a lot of people think, right? I have no intention of hiking the Appalachian Trail. Bravo, good for you. Go hike the Appalachian Trail. That's not one of the things I want to do. But all the things I want to do, I want to do those things. And I hope that God gives me enough years to be able to get them all done. But I think that's what I would do is I would just point out there's going to be an end. And at the end, you don't get to do anymore. So you're going to be a winner and say you did them all? Or are you going to say, nah, I spent all my time, you know, watching reruns of Gilligan's Island? You know, you got to get out there and do what you want to do.
So what do you have left to do since you want to do it all?
Well, what do I have a certain giving pledge that I want to be able to give a certain amount of money away in one big fat check. That's one thing. I want to be able to write a check for a certain amount to a charity that I believe in. I really do believe that I'm going to run for office again and win this time. I've really accomplished most of my writing goals. I've accomplished most of my speaking goals. You know, I want to be married in a wonderful marriage the rest of my life. And Denise and I, we have an amazing marriage. We start every day. We get up, we pour ourselves some coffee, we light a candle or the fire. We read the Bible together. We pray together for the day. We start every day together and building each other up. And that's something that we do. We travel together. We love to travel together. I want my children to have, what they want out of life. And so I try to encourage them. I try to give them good advice. You know, the older you get, you sort of start living vicariously through your kids and you take joy in the successes of others. I'd like to I'd like to be known as a mentor for other people because I had extraordinary mentors, people who believed in me. Nothing I love better than finding somebody, a guy or a girl who's 30, 35, and just telling them, you know what, you're doing fantastic. You've got the makings of a great leader. I just spoke for a guy out in Lake Las Vegas 2 or 3 months ago, young guy. He's 40. He looks like he's 28. And his fiance asked me if I would do a video for his birthday. And so I shot a video and sent it out to him. And that's what I said. You're an amazing leader. You've already done incredible things. Just keep going. Help more people. You're helping them find financial independence. And I feel like that's something I really want to be known for, is being somebody who helped as many other people as the people who helped me. Because, you know, it's not really about money. Money's a great way to keep score and enjoy certain things. But, you know, when you die, it all goes back in the box and it goes to somebody else. But the memories and the ripple effect that you make in other people's lives, that's what lives on. You know, somebody say, I met Chris Widener before he died, and I remember the encouraging word he said to me. When I moved out of New Jersey, and I moved to start churches in Seattle, I got a check from this guy who was the CEO of Mars Candies. And I thought, oh, that's cool. Cause I didn't ask anybody for money. I thought, that's cool. And the next month I got the same check and I went, oh, that's really cool. And then the third month I got it. Same. I'm like, I better call him. So I called him up and I remember him saying, I still remember this. This was no later than probably September 1991. So that's how long ago it's been. And he said, Chris, I believe in you. And I believe in what you're doing, and I'm going to keep sending you money every month. And I don't think he ever really realized just that powerful moment, because here he is, this extraordinary business leader, right? You know, and unless he worked for Mars, which is highly secretive, they were not allowed to be on covers of magazines and all this, but one of the biggest companies. And I thought, here's this successful man who said he believes in me. Wow. And I still remember that. When they asked me to be the MC for the Jim Rohn Weekend Leadership Event, wow, they believe in me enough to give me that microphone. When Zig Ziglar asked me to co-host his TV show, I'm like, wow. I remember I walked into the studio the first time. I'd never met him before. And I felt like a priest who'd been called to the Vatican to serve communion with the Pope. And so, you know, and I viewed my job as sort of like batting practice, like throw the ball, let him hit it. Throw the ball, let him hit it. And after the second or third episode, Tom came to me and Tom said, hey, I've been talking to Zig and he'd like you to talk more. He'd like you to say some of your ideas. And I went, wow, Zig wants me to talk with him and give my thoughts and my ideas. Every moment along the way, and not just famous people like Zig and those guys, but people, a kid from high school. I had not connected with this kid. I called him for his birthday. I have not talked to him in 25 years. And I told him, I said, you know, I want to wish you a happy birthday. We're still Facebook friends. And I said, I also want to tell you that you gave me one of my best pieces of advice. I think it changed my speaking career. It was in the early 90s, probably 93. He came and saw me speak. And when I came off stage, he said, Chris, you're amazing. I always knew you were going to be amazing. You're a fantastic speaker. And he said, but can I give you some advice? And I said, sure. And he said, if you want to be world class, I'm going to give you a piece of advice. I said, what's that? He said, you need to be as funny on stage as you are off stage. And I went, huh? He goes, you're hilarious. When we're just sitting around shooting the bull, you're hilarious, but you're too uptight up there. And he was dead right. I thought I needed to be a professional speaker. I'm a professional. I've got the microphone now and these people are listening to me, you know, and I'm going to proclaim the truth. And then I just realized I just need to be myself. His name's Roy Bonsgard. And Roy told me in like 1992, 1993, be as funny on stage as you are off stage. And now I goof around and I act things out and I use funny voices and, you know, all sorts of stuff. And I truly believe that was one of the best pieces of advice I could ever get. It was from a kid I went to high school with. And he told me, be as funny on stage as you are off stage. I was being somebody else. I was trying to be somebody else.
Why did you say that you think that you'd go back into politics? Like what's the draw?
My theory is one of the problems in America on both sides. And I consider myself an equal opportunity political basher. I have my own beliefs, but frankly, I would vote. I don't care what your label is. If you vote what I think is right, I would totally support you. I don't care left, right, blue, black, orange, right, red, blue. I don't care. But I have a theory And my theory is that the problem with politics today is we have the willing, not the able. And our job is to convince the able to become willing. And it goes to what Todd just said. If I were to ever run, remember what you just said? If I were to ever run, I would do it to find out what I did in college. And that's a lot of people's problem. I have a billionaire friend of mine who I have begged to run for politics. I have said to him, your country needs you. Like, I've played the your country needs you card. No, not going to do it. And you think about a lot of these folks, they're like, hey, I could sit on my 400-foot yacht on the weekends, or I could have them pick apart every little nuance of my life that ever happened. You know, I smoked weed once at a college party, and, you know, and that's the problem. We have the willing and not the able, and we need to convince the able to become willing. And I believe that I'm able. I believe that I'm fair. I definitely have my opinions, but I'm fair. And I believe that I'm willing to listen to the other side. I will make my voice firmly heard. But if I'm wrong, I'll admit I'm wrong. And I think we're in a heck of a problem. I think we're in real trouble, from national debt, which has been run up by both sides. Both of them spend like drunken sailors, except I wouldn't want to embarrass drunken sailors. When I ran for the U.S. Senate in 2010, our national debt was $9 trillion. It's over $30 trillion now, 12 years later. And that is a burden on our children, and it's something that real Americans need to take a closer look at, things like that. And I don't care what your label is. I just care that we do the right thing and we leave this country better than we did before. So that's why I don't need the fame. It certainly doesn't pay that well. For some people, they would think that's a lot of money, but it's really not that much money for all the crap you have to take. And I just believe it's something that I could make a difference in. I think that I'm a good communicator. I think that I could communicate some ideals in such a way that I could put together a coalition of people who maybe don't agree with me in everything, but say I trust this guy enough to not go wacko off the rails. You know, we vote for people, and then next thing you know, they're like, they take a right turn or a left turn. You're like, I didn't think that was going to happen. So I guess that's a long-winded answer to a short question.
I was going to say, that goes right back to your friend telling you to be yourself on stage and off stage. Same thing with politics.
I have a speaking tour that we run, and we actually have a rule there. No bashing, no negative, no comments, no whatever. I don't believe in calling the other side names. Have a civil discussion. Our founding fathers, man, they fought like crazy when they were hammering out the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And then when they were done, I mean, they would just duke it out and like, no way, you're wrong. Federalism, anti-federalism, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then what'd they do at 8 o'clock at night? They were drinking pints of beer down at the pub. Because ultimately, I believe that all people are God's people. And as I always say, at the foot of the cross, we're all the same. And we might have differences in politics, we might have differences in sexual preference, or, you know, all those kinds of things. But I believe that we all want our country to be better. And I think that we need able leaders who can lead in a positive way and do that.
Lead and listen to each other. I agree with you. I think society has become very siloed, and there's no opportunity for dialogue anymore. You know, we're at this point in our society, North American society anyways, where you're either left or you're right. And there's, you know, let's if we really want to dive into culture for a second, let's look at what's happened with Whoopi Goldberg and the conversation around the Holocaust and how, you know, she was suspended for 2 weeks. Now, you know, my wife and I were actually talking about this morning, and it's interesting that I look at a lot of the so-called right-wing pundits out there that are, you know, kind of speaking about this, and everybody on the right of the center of the equation is all saying, it seems to me, that hey, you know, it's great that they suspended her, but we're going down this path where we're not allowing free speech to happen anymore. Right. But then you've got the people on the left that are like, cancel Joe Rogan, right? Cancel this, cancel that. And how do we bridge the divide, I think, is the big question that we've come down to right now. I don't know if you guys are watching what's happening in Canada right now, but we've got this trucker convoy that's occupying our capital city, our national capital city in Ottawa. And I as a Canadian, we really feel like this has really started to open up some dialogue, and the left and the right are actually starting to speak to each other now in more of a with civil language and the idea of civil discourse.
Stuff delivered, they better start talking to each other because those truckers aren't moving.
That's right. They aren't moving at all.
Saved by a bunch of truckers. No, I agree.
That's right.
We have to be willing to listen. But here's the problem. And frankly, if this would have been, take the Whoopi Goldberg thing, the same people are saying, why did they cancel her? If it would have happened on a right-wing show, they would have said, cancel him, fire him, send him to prison. Everybody, nobody has the integrity. When your guy does it, it's bad. When my guy does it, well, he didn't mean to do it. Right.
Right.
You know, you look at the governor of Virginia that just got ousted. Right. The guy was in blackface and, you know, but if that would have been a right winger, he'd have been gone the minute the picture hit the news. Right. And vice
versa. Chris, our prime minister was found to have black in three separate instances. Right. And he's still the prime minister of our country. And he's left. So
here's the problem. When somebody else does something wrong, we judge their actions. When we do something wrong or our side does the wrong, we judge their intentions. That's the problem. We don't judge our actions. We judge our intentions. I didn't mean to. I was only having fun. It was college, you know, whatever. He did it. Fire him. And both sides do it. But I do a little thing. I play a little game with people when we're arguing politics. I'll say, hey, let's do something fun. How about this? How about we switch sides? You take my side. I'll take your side. And you know what almost inevitably happens? They don't know my side.
Right.
I'm not the first person they've ever talked to that holds my opinions, but they've never listened. I want to listen because, frankly, I don't want to pick a side. I want to pick the truth. And I don't care where the truth comes from. There's positions that I hold that are on the other side that other people would say, that's a position the other people hold. And I go, well, I think it's right. I think it's the truth. So I don't care if that party happens to be the one that perpetuates it. I want the truth. I want what's best for us, not just I want what's best for my little, as you called it, silo. And I agree. We are in polarized silos. And even within each of the two parties, you have silos, right? All of a sudden, somebody who you thought was on your side, they go off one way and they say something. They agree with 95% of you, but they say one thing and it's like, kick him out of the party, you know? And Ronald Reagan used to say, if somebody's with me 80% of the time, they're on my side. You're never going to agree with somebody on everything. So we not only do it to the other side, we do it to the people in our own group. And it's really unfortunate. It's really unfortunate. We need to listen. We need to all calm down. We need to stop labeling people. And we need to listen. And we might find some things that we agree with on the other side. And frankly, I think we need to get to know other people. I have a lot of friends of mine who hold really, really opposite opinions of mine, but I really like them. And frankly, you know, they root me on this tour that we're doing, which is a political tour. There are people who hold wildly different positions of mine, but they text me and they say, I'm so proud of you. I'm proud that you're standing for what you believe in. It's amazing what you've pulled off. This is fantastic. And these are people who are pretty much diametrically opposed to me in my political beliefs. And I write back to them. I say, you do not know how much that means to me. I know you don't agree with me, but the fact that you're rooting me on is really beautiful, and I consider you a friend.
My daughter and I were having a conversation the other day, and she's in fourth grade, and they were talking politics on the playground. And she had asked me about this view that another child had said, and I said, whoa, hold on. Regardless of that view, why are you guys talking about politics on the playground? You're in fourth grade.
That's what I want to know. Shouldn't they be like, playing blackjack?
Yeah. And she goes, well, I didn't understand what they were talking about. I said, and it's because you guys don't know enough to have an opinion. The knowledge that you guys hold at your age is not enough to have an opinion. Talk about horses, play cops and robbers, play like something other than politics. But she goes, I just don't understand because it seems like everybody's so mad at each other. There's two sides to politics, right? And I said, yes, you know, you have your, and I talked about that. And she said, I just don't get it. I said, well, what do you think would fix it? She says, I think people just need to be kind and respectful.
Have you ever heard of a guy named Bob Goff? This is totally true. You reminded me of a story. There's a guy named Bob Goff. You should have him on the show. And I tried to get a movie deal around this story. I tried to sell this story as a movie because this is a true story. He's a very wealthy attorney. And on 9/11, his children were at home and they didn't have televisions. And he was at work at his office and he came home and he wanted to break the news to his children. And so he started talking, said, you know, what do you think we ought to do? And they basically said, we need to become friends with people from around the world. We should reach out to people from around the world. Every part of this is a true story. It's one of the most beautiful stories I've ever heard. So he says, well, what do you think you guys could do? And they said, we should write a letter to the president of another country. And he said, which country should you write a letter to? And they said, all of them. And he said, okay. And he said, he says in his book, I didn't know there were like 275 countries, but we did. We wrote a letter to 275 countries and said, we would like to come and visit you. And Bob told his children, if anybody lets you, we'll go. And he's like, that was a mistake. He said, we ended up spending 6 months traveling from country to country to country to country. They had so many presidents and prime ministers and dictators and everybody invite them. And he tells one story. He doesn't say that it's Russia, but he says that they were speaking Russian. So it might have been part of the Soviet Union was done by then. I don't know when it was. But anyway, these kings and presidents would bring their whole family in. And he said at one point they're sitting there in this prime minister, I think it was Putin, I don't know, whoever was in charge back in the early 2000s, that I kind of read between the lines. And he comes in, he says, do you children love pastries or sweets? And he said, we love sweets. And he like this, and in comes this parade of people with cakes and pies and cookies and everything. And they're just eating. And these presidents would spend time with Bob and his wife and three or four little kids. At the end of every meeting, they gave the president a gift box. And I think they lived in Colorado at the time. And in the gift box, they opened it up and it was a keychain with a working key to their front door. And they said, you are welcome in our home anytime you want to come to America. True story. One of the most amazing stories I've ever heard. It should be a movie. And so about, I don't know, 2 years later, one of the kids gets an email from the prime minister of this other country. We're coming to America and we miss our American friends and your visit that you had in our country. And we would like to know if that key still works. And they stayed in Bob Goff's home. And I think that it is such a powerful story. You should have him on just to tell that story because he could probably go into way more detail and tell lots of fun stories. This was just a chapter in one of his books. But what an amazing thing. You know, that's one of the things about my travels. You know, I've traveled Russia, Egypt, Singapore, China, Australia, Spain, Germany, you know, all over, right? I remember going to Egypt. I've been to Egypt twice speaking, once in Cairo and once outside of Cairo in one of their new cities they built. And I remember they took me through, you know, went to the pyramids and went to the Sphinx, and they took me to the Papyrus Museum. And they had a driver. They took me to and then they had a guy who was a university professor and taught me things and all those kinds of things and about history. And at one point, I knew they were only taking me to the nice places. Like I knew they were kind of keeping me off the beaten path. And I said, I want to go to where the real people live. I don't want to go the touristy places. And he kind of looked at me like this, like, are you sure? And I said, yeah. I mean, we didn't get out and do a lot of things, but I wanted to see how people live. I wanted to see what life was really like. And that's been one of the best things is you realize that people may live in a different place, but in many ways, we're all the same. In fact, I gave a speech to 7,000 Iranians in Tehran via Skype probably 2 years ago. 7,000 people, and I'm looking at them on the screen because their computer, I could see the crowd. They had me up on the IMAGs. And at the very end, I gave about a 1 minute little speech at the end. I said, before I close, I want to tell you something. I know that my government and your government don't get along, and there's lots of fighting and there's lots of arguing and those kinds of things. But here's what I know about people. I know that you love your spouse, and I know that you love your children, and I know that you want to have a healthy, long, healthy life filled with love and joy. And so do we Americans. And in many ways, the Iranians and the Americans, forget the governments. The Americans and the Iranian people are very, very similar in regard to how we want our lives to be. And I got a 2-minute standing ovation via Skype. And I don't believe it was for the speech I gave. I believe it was for the connection I made at the very end when I said, look, our governments may fight, but we're the same. We want the same thing. We want love. We want life. We want joy. We want our children to have a better life than we did. And that's the common denominator. There's a lot of arguing about how to get there, but we all pretty much want the same thing.
Wow.
Vote for Chris Widener. Thank you very much.
There we go.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Well, you have some hell of a speeches, I guess, since you've written your own speeches and you've written speeches. Yet I believe presidencies and governors and mayors basically win on their speech writers and how they deliver it. So
there's a lot of that. There was one presidential candidate who didn't take my advice, and he should have.
Who was that? Can you mention that name?
Yeah, I'll tell the story. John McCain's team called me, and they said, how can we he wouldn't have won anyway. I'll tell you that. Obama was a freight train coming down the tracks. It was never going to get beat. But they called me up, and they said, we want you to help Senator McCain compete with Obama on the teleprompter. And I said, okay, I'm going to give you 2 pieces of advice. The first piece of advice is the advice you don't want, but you should take. And the second piece of advice is the advice you want, but you shouldn't take. And they said, okay, what's the advice that we should take that we don't want? And I said, dump the teleprompter. Whoa, we can't dump the teleprompter. This is the other problem with politicians. You got like these 26-year-old kids who are 4 years out of the University of Virginia telling them every single word they can say and can't say. And I'm like, you're a 60-year-old billionaire. Say what you want.
Yeah,
right? And so when he went, why we can't take him off the teleprompter? I said, he's the Maverick. Like his brand is literally the Maverick. Right. He's been in the United States Senate for 185 years. He should know his stuff at this point. We can't do it. They sterilize everything. Everything is sterilized with these politicians. And whether you like Trump or not, I think that's one of the reasons he won. No sterilization. It was unbridled opinion. And you knew where you stood with him, whether you liked him or not. And again, whether you like him or not, that's up to you. But that's one of the things that I think was different than the average politician. Because I'll tell you what, I know people on my side and on the other side, they're nothing but stuffed blue suits. And they'll tell you exactly what they think you want to hear. And then they go do something else. So anyway, I told him, I said, dump the teleprompter. Let him be the Maverick. He knows his stuff. We can never do that. I said, fine. Just give him bullet points in the teleprompter. Let him see where he needs to go and then say what he thinks. And no, we can't do that. I said, okay, well, you're not going to take that advice, which I knew you wouldn't. So here's the advice I will give you. The problem is you have a camera and a teleprompter at 12 o'clock and at 10 o'clock and at 2 o'clock. So the problem is when he's reading the one at 12 o'clock where the camera is, and you guys can see me because we're doing video. I don't know if there's going to be video when you release it, but when you watch my eyes, I'm reading the teleprompter. Now I'm going to shift to 10 and I do this before I shift. And now, you know, I'm reading. Most people think Obama's this amazing speaker. You've never seen him speak without a teleprompter.
Correct.
Like literally you have never, he spoke at a rodeo and they drug a teleprompter into the middle of a rodeo thing. You know, they swept aside the cow manure and they put up a teleprompter. Like he is an amazing teleprompter reader, but when he goes off the teleprompter, Google it sometime, Obama loses teleprompter and you'll see, right? So I said, dump that one because everybody knows you're reading. Now, the best part of it is that John McCain, the only thing anybody can ever remember about a single speech he gave was at when he received the Republican National Convention. He received the nomination. He gave his acceptance speech, read it. And at the very end, he went off the teleprompter. And that's the only part anybody can, because he got fired up. It's time to fire up. And he was him. He was the Maverick. He was the Maverick. He was himself. Like we've been talking about this whole podcast. He finally became himself. And he should have been himself the entire time and he would have lost by less. He would have lost by a much lesser margin.
Chris, this has been amazing. If anyone wants to learn more about what you do or perhaps book your speaking services, where could they learn more about you?
ChrisWidener.com. They can find all my books there. They go to ChrisWidener.com. If they hit the store, it'll take them to Amazon. They'll see the dozens and dozens of audio programs and books and all that kind of stuff. And there's an email there, Chris@ChrisWidener.com. Very simple.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a lot of fun. I love what you guys are doing. And I appreciate you letting me be part of the team for even an hour or so. It's great.
Thanks for listening to Gain the Passion. Please rate, review, and share the podcast. And don't forget to hit the follow or subscribe button.